He is now Oxford's Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography. And his topic is the geography of inequality. Danny Lawley.
Thank you. Thank you ever so much for inviting me. Can you hear me at the back okay?
Yes.
Brilliant, right at the back, excellent. I don't have any slides or graphs or pictures. I apologise for that. I often do, but it can get a bit overwhelming if I reel out some numbers and statistics to you and then also show you the tables and numbers and show you the graphs and show you the maps. And I've begun to learn that not everybody loves these things as much as I do. So instead I'm going to sort of tell you a little story about what's been going on in Britain, and I'll try and talk a bit about Oxford and Oxfordshire as well, and what we could do about it and what may be happening about it. When I grew up, I was born in 1968, and so I grew up in the 1970s, we were the second most equal large country in Europe. Only Sweden had a lower income inequality than we did. Now, many people complain about the 1970s and say there were many things terrible then. I personally quite like them. I can remember, who can remember 1976? Very good, long hot summer. There was strike, see, if you're a child, you know, all the strikes meant is you only had to go to school for 3 days and you had candles in your house. But I know it was rough, but it wasn't rough if you were a child, of course. It also wasn't that rough if you were young adults like my parents. So my parents could buy a house in Cowley for £400. They bought a house in Cowley because although they had me in Jericho, you wouldn't bring up a baby in Jericho back then if you know your Oxford geography. Now you couldn't afford to bring up a baby in Jericho. Things changed greatly. But back in the 1970s, the gaps between those who had the most and those who had the least in this country was at the lowest it had ever been. We still had near full employment until the end of the 1970s. Although housing was a problem for some people and you had Cathy come home and so on, it was possible to start a family, to house yourself, for the large majority of people. And because of the security of employment and the security of relationships as well, you could get a job and you could get a mortgage from a building society. We still had building societies were the main lenders back then. And you could pay that mortgage off over 25 years and eventually you would own that home. And I'm just generalising from your ages, but many of you will have done this and could do it at that point. Now, what's happened since then, as the economic gaps between people have got wider and wider and wider, in the south of England, just being able to get a home and start a family has become incredibly hard. So I come back to Oxford 2 years ago, and I look around the schools in Oxford. I've been to quite a lot of the schools, the state schools and quite a lot of the private schools. And the shocking thing is finding so many teachers, the majority of teachers in the case of most schools, being 25 years or younger. And what's happening is that they're getting jobs in the schools. Oxford is, of course, particularly expensive. They're renting. The rent in Oxford is twice a mortgage, and they've got no chance of a mortgage. So they're paying 50 or 60% of their income on rent. And after a few years, they just simply get sick of it and they go and find a teaching job somewhere else. Now, it doesn't mean that we get lots of enthusiastic, young, bright teachers, but you do need some teachers who are a little bit older. There's a huge problem getting heads for primary schools in Oxford. I think the last 11 posts that were advertised, 9 were ended up being internally appointed, often to people who didn't want to become the head because they couldn't get somebody to be the head because of the cost of housing. I'm going to try not to say much more about housing until the end because I like seeing your sign there, and I will probably cause dissent and upset. I agree with you, but anyway, you say don't go there. I'll talk about housing towards the end of this. But we do have problems, and these problems are new. There's one primary school which apparently lost 80% of its staff last year, had to replace them. Another one lost 50% the year before. And these are problems about inequality. It's the problem that a teacher can no longer afford a home because the price of the home has risen. Why has the price of the home risen? Initially because there were more people paid a lot more than the teachers who could buy those homes. But eventually, there were more investors. The majority of houses in Oxford are now bought by investors and landlords. The problem with that for teachers and university lecturers and other people is that your security as a private tenant is very, very poor. It's better in almost every other European country. So you know that you can be turfed out with just 2 months' notice. If you're starting a family and your children are going to go to a local primary school, you want them to be able to stay at the local primary school. You really don't want to move your children around. One in four families with children in England are now renting privately. It's been a huge increase in the last 10 years. It was an unplanned increase. But the problem is the insecurity for many people of renting privately. It's most high in London. It means that in London you're looking at average moves every 2 years. And if you've got kids, children really want to stay with their friends. They want to stay at the same school. They don't want to move around and around. So we have lots of problems like that. We also have lots of things which have got much, much better. So let's just talk about some of the things that have got better before getting a bit depressed again about what's got worse. The gaps between men and women have narrowed at an incredible rate in many ways. There's still pay differences and there's still huge inequalities. But the change between my mother's generation, when she wouldn't have been allowed to get a mortgage on her own because you had to have a man, and my grandmother's generation, when she wouldn't have been allowed to go to university, very few women did back then, is incredible. To the generation now, where half of young women in England go to university and only one in three young men go to university, when young women are doing so much better than young men in other ways. And there are other ways in which we have become more equal. We've become more equal in terms of tolerance to people who have different family lives and so on. An incredible change over the last 20 or 30 years, from it being illegal for teachers to talk about homosexuality to having gay marriage. And we've had a huge increase in tolerance about people of different backgrounds, religion and race. I can remember, one of my memories of the 1970s was the National Front. And the National Front were in Oxford and they weren't particularly nice. That kind of thing is very, very much more muted now, particularly in the southeast of England and particularly in London. So lots of things have actually improved. There's also been a great improvement in the extent that people are aware of inequality and difference and not wanting to look down at others and not wanting to have differences which are not justified. You see it in the accents of people at the top of society changing, almost being deliberately dumbed down. The Queen's accent in particular is important. I don't think it's deliberate, but the Queen has changed her accent over time. But recent Prime Ministers don't wear ties. They dress differently, and then it's partly their PR people are telling them to dress differently. And it's some kind of sensitivity to just how divided we were in the past by things like dress. There's a lovely cartoon from the 1920s and 30s that has four men on a ladder, all stepping down the ladder because they had austerity in the 1930s. And the man at the top of the ladder has a bowler hat on, and the man at the bottom has a flat cap on, and the two men in the middle have the appropriate hats for the men. And the man at the bottom is stepping into water and drowning. And the problem is that if the person at the bottom has to take a cut as well as everybody else taking a cut, it's obviously worse when you get to the bottom. But we no longer are able to tell people's social class and position from their clothing. Not quite as easily as we could. Your postcode, though, if you give me your postcode, that's a fairly good way. And if I know your job and your postcode, I can then begin to try to work out your wealth. whether you managed to get that postcode just by yourself or you got some help and those kind of things. Okay, that was me trying to be a bit jolly. let's get the person. And the other thing, of course, before we stop being jolly, our overall standard of living has risen incredibly. You know, double glazing is now the norm, central heating is now the norm. Outdoor plumbing is a sign of affluence. Actually having an outdoor toilet is something that only the very best of now have anymore. Not having a television is now a sign of affluence. You know, a huge number of things, of course, absolutely better, and it's very important to recognise that. But we currently have, the newspapers came out with a statistic last week, 1 in 4 of everybody working, I think it's in the UK, not England, in the UK outside of London, is working on less than a living wage. It's a quarter of the population. We're about to get the most Stalinist intervention. George Osborne has promised to increase the pay of that 1 in 4 of the population up to a government set wage. This is something that only communist countries used to do. But it shows the degree of concern of inequality that the Conservative Chancellor is proposing to increase the wages of a quarter of the population. I don't think he was aware it was a quarter when he made the pledge. The statistic had been 11%, and ONS has been a bit slow releasing the statistic. Anyway, it is a quarter. Our poorest fifth in the United Kingdom receive less in absolute terms than the poorest fifth anywhere else in Western Europe, which is something of a shock. But forget the poorest fifth. If you look at the median family, the middle family in this country, the average income of the middle family is lower than it is of the middle family in France and of the middle family in Germany by several thousand euros. And we often talk about France as if France is some terribly badly run economy. And the thing you've got to ask is, if France is a terribly run economy, how come the middle family is so much better off? They're also being better housed on average. The quality of housing is better on the continent on average, and the cost of housing is much lower. So some things have gone badly wrong. My argument about what's gone badly wrong is that different countries went in different directions from the 1970s onwards. And there are reasons as to why this happened. They all went in the same direction from 1913 to the 1970s. In 1913, all affluent countries in the world were very unequal. The richest 1% took a fifth of all income. So it was a Downton Abbey kind of society 100 years ago. The most common job for women, the modal job, was being a servant. In all countries of the rich world, that inequality decreased from the First World War through to the 1970s. It decreased slowly at first in the US, but then fast after the Second World War. But in places like the United Kingdom, it increased quickly after the First World War. Half the gain we made in inequality was made by 1939. So it wasn't just the Second World War which made us more cohesive. Then we get to a situation in the 1970s where inequalities are low everywhere, but there's some variation, and we were similar to Sweden. And then we began to go in different directions. The Dutch managed to keep their inequalities low. So the best off 1% in the Netherlands are taking about 7 times average income, 7% of all income. The Swiss did the same. So the best off 1% in Switzerland are taking about 8% of average income. Here, the best off 1% are taking about 15% of average income, which means that a banker, because 97% of the 1% are in finance, a banker in London is getting twice as much as a banker in Geneva or Zurich. And the interesting question is, how did that come about? We have over 2,200 bankers receiving over €1 million a year in income. The next highest figure in Europe is 197 in Germany. So if we were to raise marginal rates of income tax ever so slightly, which would affect our bankers, there are no banking jobs for them to go to in Europe that would pay anything like what they're paid at the moment. They would have to go to New York. And the Americans would have to resign from their jobs and let them have the jobs. It's got to an incredible extent of inequality. To be in the 1%, in case you're wondering if you're there, by income you need, if you're on your own, to have about £160,000 a year. If there's two of you, you need about £200,000 a year to be in the best off 1% by income. By wealth, which you're slightly more likely to be in the best off 1% by wealth, forget about your main property and forget about your pension. If your other assets are worth about £1 million, if you've got a spare liquid million, you're in the 1% by wealth. Now, it's interesting to look at Oxford and Oxfordshire in this state of affairs. Oxfordshire has had more change than the country as a whole. Oxfordshire, when I was born, was a set of villages, some of which didn't have gas. Electricity had only just arrived. There was abject poverty out here in the county. When Joseph Rowntree's son, Seaborn Rowntree, did his studies of poverty, which he did of York numerous times, he also did a study of rural poverty 100 years ago. And rural poverty was incredibly stark. Likewise to Camelford, is that familiar to you? It's nearby, it's Juniper Hill. All those descriptions really were true through to the 1960s and in some cases through to the 1970s. Then things began to change, gas got connected, electricity got connected. Somebody built the M40. I think that was the key one. They built the M40, and if you're on junction 9 or 10 of the M40, the world changes. So what people often don't realise is it's areas near here that have been transformed the most in some ways. But when an area is transformed, it's not obvious what used to be there before. As opposed to a pit village up north, where because the pit head's still there and there isn't anything else, you know it's a pit village. So Grimthorpe, it's obvious. I gave a talk in the primary school I went to recently, which is Wood Farm School in Oxford. When I went to Wood Farm School, almost everybody's dad worked in the car factory. I asked the 8-year-olds and 9-year-olds, do you know what most people's mum and dad did when I went here? And they hadn't got a clue. They had no idea that Wood Farm Estate was built for car workers. Because although the factory is still there but only employs 3,000 pretty well paid people now, lots of other jobs have come in. And so you're not left with a kind of industrial relic in East Oxford. East Oxford's changed and there's no memory of that change. And in the same way, I think rural Oxfordshire has had that change. For areas which have been left or abandoned, the history is obvious. For areas where something else has come in, it's less obvious. Now, I'm going on too long, and I do want to get on to housing and something specific. Health inequalities. Our health inequalities are very wide. By geographical region, the only country which comes near to us in Europe for health inequalities is Germany. The German health inequalities are less, and that's between the Eastern Land and the old East Germany and the West, and they've managed to narrow those inequalities. Whereas our life expectancy differences between the North and South are the widest regional inequalities you'll find in Europe. Glasgow at one point had a life expectancy the same as the Gaza Strip, whereas parts of Kensington and Chelsea have incredibly high life expectancy, heading up into the 90s for women. And at one point a few years ago, life expectancy in Kensington, Chelsea and Westminster was going up by more than a year. Go on.
Could you use the microphone?
Oh, shall I shout louder?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Let's try double. Does this help? Let's try that. Is that a bit better for you? That's clearer. Okay. Right. So we have wide health inequalities. The good news, though, is that our life expectancy is actually rising slightly faster than European average at the moment. But the only reason it's rising faster than European average is because it's rising particularly fast in London. And it's rising fast in London because lots of young, healthy Europeans are coming into London. But anyway, that is helping our life expectancy not trail behind. the rest of Europe, which it was doing before we saw the big increase in immigration. The wealth divides are incredibly big, and they rise with a 20-year lag after the income divides rise. So in London, the poorest tenth of children have at least 100 times less wealth or access to wealth than the best off tenth of children. 100-fold differences in wealth are absolutely enormous. Political divides have risen between areas. So in the 1960s and 70s, you would find people voting for both Labour and the Conservative Party everywhere. Slightly more for the Conservative Party out here, slightly more for the Labour Party in Oxford East, but not usually. And then since 1979, the polarisation in voting geographically has risen election after election after election. The biggest increases in Conservative voting have been in Conservative areas. In areas that's not Conservative, the Conservative voting has dropped and dropped. The last Conservative left Scotland several decades ago almost. I mean, there is still one seat. But it's an incredible state of affairs to get to. You can measure voting polarisation by a segregation index. And the last election, 2015 election, we exceeded the last historic maximum, which was the 1918 Kharki election, to get us the most polarised general election ever in terms of how people vote. Oxford East, the Labour vote has risen twice in the last two elections. It looks like a pitch village in terms of, if you didn't know anything else about it apart from the fact that 50% of people vote Labour, you would think this is a double mining seat. And this is quite an incredible thing. I'll give you one more political statistic, which really is unusual. At the last election, a third of people on the electoral roll didn't vote. There's quite a lot of people who are not on the electoral roll, and that's rising. But a third didn't vote. The rest of the vote was incredibly split between more parties than normal. So the Conservatives only won 25% of the electorate. Only one in four people who could vote voted Conservative. But they just got a majority government. I did think that no other rich country in the history of democracy had managed to do this. Until recently, I found out that in Colombia, somebody managed to secure an election with just 18% of the electorate. But it is a really extreme situation to get into when just one in four people, because of the arithmetic and the political geography, end up securing a majority government. When people tell you that the next election is a foregone conclusion, you do have to remember this election was based on only one in four people voting one particular way and a very split vote between other parties. Just a word about social mobility and then let's do housing. The government are very worried about social mobility. There's a Social Mobility and Child Poverty Commission that's been running for years. It's just having the word child poverty taken out of its title, so it'll only worry about social mobility. All the official measures of child poverty are about to be abandoned by the incoming government. The good news, if you like measures of child poverty, and one thing the current government doesn't realise, is that they're all still going to be measured by European statistics, so we'll still be able to know what the rate is, unless we leave Europe. And this is the really interesting thing coming up, because it looks like a 50-50 vote at the moment. I'd happily talk about that and what might happen if we were to do it. But everybody's concerned about social mobility, the chances for people to go up from the bottom. They don't talk so much about the need for people to go down from the top. Unless some people go down a bit from the top, you can't go up from the bottom. Social mobility really matters in a very, very unequal country. In a more equal country, it's less important whether your child rises or falls because they're not falling that far and they're not rising that high. But in a country like the United Kingdom, if your child is going from, say, being on the 90th percentile, in a better off situation than 9 out of 10 other children, down to the 10th, you really are moving across social worlds. You're going from having a chance of owning your own property after a number of years, which the best off 10th can still do, down to a chance of really worrying about being homeless at various points in your life and only ever paying rent. This makes people incredibly and understandably protective for their children in a country like the United Kingdom and trying to do whatever they can to help them. But it doesn't necessarily help the whole of society. If we look at people's ability to do various things, we can test the ability of maths in different countries. We in the United States, at the age of 15, our children are fairly poor at maths. They're much better at maths in places like Finland and Japan and so on, which are more equal. But the really interesting thing about these tests is that although those countries are a bit better than us at age 15, those countries are much better than us at age 24. So the worrying thing is that we're teaching people maths in a way which doesn't help them remember or actually learn maths, so that when you test them later, they're not so good at it. And I think what's happening is that we're becoming obsessed by exam results, because exam results really matter in a competitive society. You can teach somebody to get an A star or to get a C, and that's a different thing from teaching them to enjoy maths. Teaching children to get one grade above what they might otherwise gets them that grade, but it doesn't tend to actually get them the enjoyment or understanding, which might be why we do so much worse when this is measured later. Okay, housing. Housing is probably the most important single issue that's affected by inequality, because everybody has to be housed. Not everybody works, not everybody worries about whether they've got a job or not, not everybody worries about education because they're not in education or their children are not in education. But everybody worries about housing. Housing, Oxford is now the most expensive town in the country. I think the average house is 15 times the average income. The average income in Oxford is about £21,000. London's about 14 to 1 because in London they have higher salaries, because of London waiting. London prices have just passed £500,000 for the average property. Oxford economic forecasts say that London will hit £1 million by 2030 as the average property price in London. London is already the most expensive large city on the planet, became it about 2 years ago. And at the moment, London is seeing 15% annual price rises because of a surprise election result. The prices have damped slightly before the election because you could have had a mansion tax, other things could have come in. Now they're off the agenda, the prices are shooting up. This affects Oxford and Oxfordshire. A kind of slightly like a nuclear bomb going off is a house price bubble in London. You get a great big boom in the capital and then you get this ripple that moves out across. The ripple went across Oxford about a year ago. It went across the county slightly slower. It resulted in £60,000 rises in average property out towards the Prime Minister's seat. Just in about 3 months, everything went up by £60,000. Small things affected. If you open the mainline rail station in North Oxford with direct trains to get you into the station above Harley Street in an hour, It's obvious what's going to happen when you do that. So there will be a little bubble already around here. But housing's become incredibly unaffordable. We are seeing rising numbers of, well, I call them young. These are people in their 30s, late 30s and early 40s not buying. If the current trend continues, we're going to head back towards a society of majority renting. So I'm going to give you some suggestions about what to do about that. You can have lots of suggestions about what you do about inequality. Raising people's standards at the bottom helps, but curtailing excess at the top also helps. It is incredibly expensive allowing your best off 1% to have 15% of all income. It's about 1.5 national health services. It's incredibly expensive having the richest 1,000 families in Britain doubling their wealth in 5 years. It's the same as 1,100 royal families. And it just costs you a lot of money. It's real money. Other countries control the 1% better. The 1%, they're always the same size. It's always 1% of the population. They always have the most. But they can have half as much in some countries as in others. And who's in the 1% can change. So when I was a child, the 1% consisted of head teachers, of doctors, of local business people with small factories. They would be in the 1%. Bankers were paid a lot less. You basically could be in the 1% on an income of about £50,000 a year in today's terms. Would could get you into that group. Housing. How on earth are we going to cope with housing? Now, you do have to build some housing. The reason you have to build it is partly because housing doesn't last forever and does need replacing, but it's better to keep your housing stock up to scratch rather than have to do too much of that. You also have to build if you have a rising population, or stop that rising population, and this is an interesting one I'm sure we'll get onto, but you can't have a rising population and not provide more housing for them and not have a problem. But we're also using our housing more and more inefficiently. We have an increasing number of rooms that are empty in our housing. Half of this is good news, it's because we're ageing. The housing stock was almost designed for us to live to 70. And then you die at 70 and you relinquish the family home and somebody else can be in it. Because we're ageing, we need more housing, or we need more retirement housing near to where people live, because people do not want to move away from their family and their friends. But you also need to have a situation where you don't have single professionals in London buying council maisonettes which were built for a family of two with two children. That ends up with a lot of the problem in London is housing being badly used. And lastly, let me talk about 1,500 new houses in Woodstock. I know nothing about the campaign in Woodstock. I know a lot about it in Oxford. In Oxford, we have 40,000 people driving over to Greenbelt every day to come to work because there isn't any more housing in Oxford. We also have lots of people, as I said earlier, the teachers, staying for a very short amount of time and then leaving. What I've never worked out is why it is not possible to get an agreement between the county and the city so that you do not try to build 100 houses on this village, 100 houses on another village, 1,500 houses on a town, but instead build them around the edge of Oxford, which is actually where people are trying to get to. The reason for not expanding villages is that 100 houses doesn't give you a new primary school. And if it doesn't give you a new primary school, then you're basically having more people on the roads in cars if they're going to have children. If you know that you have this large number of people already working in the city, but some of them are having to live in Birmingham, some of them are living in Wantage, it isn't good for the planet to have them travelling all the way from there to get to your city. You either get rid of the jobs in Oxford that they're doing, which would make my job rather difficult because somebody has to make sure my computer works, or you very sensitively and carefully build on the edge of this city that's been constrained for 40 years. I come back to Oxford and I ask the chief planner, what have you been doing? I've been in Sheffield, I've built houses there, I've been in Leeds, I've been in Bristol. I come back and find nothing's happened to Oxford. It's no wonder it has a problem. If you were to build, and there already is building in Barton West, on the edge, within 2.5 to 3 miles of Carfax, people can get into work on a bike, or on a tram, or on a bus. They don't need to drive. And I honestly think if you either got to fossilise Oxford like Windsor, or allow it to build, and if you allow Oxford to build very, very tightly, because there's no space for cars anymore on the roads, then you don't need to build in the rest of the county as much. It's okay to expand Bicester because there's a train station. It makes sense to expand Didcot. It doesn't make much sense to expand villages. Now, Woodstock may be the exception, so I'll leave that. I really don't know. When you're talking one fine, still not big enough, you need 5,000 for a secondary school. And these community sizes are all about schools. You know, it's can you have a primary, can you have a secondary? But also, you don't want to expand places which do not have a transport link that doesn't require the use of a car. Otherwise, you're going to have to start to build motorways across Oxfordshire. And the interesting thing, apart from the complaints you'd get, for many people, Oxfordshire is a hub for vote protesters. So if you really wanted to get, you know, some quite exciting road protests, building motorways across Oxfordshire is going to get you a lot of trouble. So I'll leave you with that one, just because it interests me in particular, because I really don't understand why the villages and small towns of the county, when I've driven around and you see these signs saying, please don't build 100 houses here, why not say, please build them on the edge of Oxford as well as don't build them here? And it would help people like me a lot who are saying, we do have scrubby land off the floodplain, below the hilltops, which was in the 1927 plan for the expansion of Oxford, where this housing could be. It just happens to not be within the Oxford city boundary. And that's partly why nothing can happen. But I do think it would solve this difficulty between the county and the town. And that interests me in general. But it's connected to the overall rise in inequality. People can no longer do what my mum and dad did and buy a house for the equivalent of £400. And they also can't rely on the fact that they will necessarily make 25 years worth of mortgage payments. You don't just want people to be able to buy houses, you also want them to be able to rent houses, but on better terms than they currently can, which just means giving people some kind of security so they can't be turfed out quite as quickly, and landlords can't rise the rents as fast, which is what happens in Germany and happens in the Netherlands and to an extent happens in France and even happens in New York. So I think these things could be possible here. Sorry if I've depressed you too much, and please do put me straight, particularly on housing in Woodstock. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. That was most interesting and enlightening. And I know we've got lots of questions. Now, and what I've got to do, so you've got to be patient. You put your hand up, I walk to you, I give you this. You give it back to me, I walk to the next person who's got their hand up. Okay?
Hello, thank you for the interesting talk. You're talking about building near to Oxford. You mean building on Greenbelt? So would you like to talk about that?
Okay, yes. It's obviously very, very sensitive. What I would like to see, the Oxford Greenbelt was put in place a very long time ago. We also weren't aware of the amount of flooding you get. When the Greenbelt plans came out, there's a lovely line where they think the river will flood to, and we've got a wonderful internal Greenbelt that should be greener of houses that flood. I would like to see acres added to the edge of Oxford off the Greenbelt, but for every acre you put in, you put, say, another 10 on the Greenbelt elsewhere, particularly land that is actually environmentally of value, ancient woodland and that kind of thing, which can be left off because the Greenbelt was done very quickly. But I am talking about cutting into the Greenbelt. However, it must be green. So you're talking about adding settlements where, although people will be able to have cars, you're not talking about parking for two cars per household. This isn't Barrett Home detached. Housing, the key thing is the very, very nearness of the distance, which allows you to use other forms of transport to get in, because Oxford's a medieval city. It was never designed to have the car in it, even though it had a car factory that came later. You know, it's a city that looks good with bicycles in it, but that's only Victorian. It really does need at some point a tram system coming in, not least because, particularly, the middle class will get on trams, so they don't like getting on buses, but it's a factor. Grenoble, our twin city, has a tram system. We have some very straight roads in which you could put a tram system in, but you can only fund the tram system with the money you would raise by building housing on the edge that would need the tram to get in. And also cycle routes and cycleways, in the way that many European cities have cycle routes. Now, not everybody can cycle, but in the UK, only 1% of people over 65 cycle. In the Netherlands, it's a quarter. And it's pretty, having spent 10 years in Sheffield, it really is pretty flat down here. I'd even put a rope going up Headington Hill that you could hold on to for people. But it has to be done sensibly. The nice thing about Oxford is that amount of interest and protest is so much, I hope it wouldn't be possible to do something stupid. Lots of stupid things have been suggested in the past, you know, putting a road through Christchurch Meadow and so on. I would hope, my worry is, that local district councils will not meet their strategic housing allowances, at which point private developers are allowed to simply go in and do what they like. And we're very near to that point with some of our neighbouring districts, at which point the equivalent of Barrett's will move in and build detached houses with a tiny gap for the next detached house, a tiny gap for the next one, with a double garage, because that's what they can sell for the most. That doesn't house as many people as you can house in other ways. It doesn't give me the other thing. If I was king, I mean, you could tell I'm a megalomaniac from this, but nice answer. I would like to see European-style apartments around the edge of Oxford, which don't require you to use stairs, because I want the elderly of Oxford to be able to move from family houses just a mile to retirement apartments with very good views of the Dreaming Spires. It's very hard to get a view of the Dreaming Spires at the moment. Not least because I like elderly people and want them to be around, but we also put on 100 public lectures a week in the university, and our students can only go to so many of them, and it would be quite nice to get a bigger audience in university and to stop the town becoming too young. It's getting younger and younger and younger in some ways. But it has to be done sensitively. In my wildest utopian dreams, I think, why the hell couldn't you do it with stone? But stone is a bit expensive. But it's begun with 800 houses on Barton Park. There's another development at Kidlington. It'll be piecemeal. There isn't an overall vision because it's so politically sensitive, nobody says, you know, could you have a look at doing this and what would be good and what's not good? And you need to do that, not least because most of the expansion has been north and south, and that's where the rivers run. And flooding may get worse in the future. Okay, we can put a relief river near Botley. All we do then is flood Reading. Reading can put a relief river, then we'll flood the west end of London. But the water has to go somewhere as well, and that needs to be thought about.
Having been very much involved in housing and in architecture, I do despair sometimes, particularly when I was working in places where there were problems about shortage of housing in rural communities. People were asking us in an advisory capacity what they could do about it. And the answer is, build more houses. And they were very safe. People are objecting to have houses built.
Yeah.
The same communities, though, not necessarily the same individuals. Yeah. To such an extent, we have funding from the Housing Corporation for one project in the village. The objections went on so long, the funding was withdrawn. Yeah. Housing, and people were, the younger people were troubling. But the point I really wanted to raise is the issue about the affordability of housing. Housing for centuries has never really been affordable for people at the bottom end of the earning spectrum.
Yeah.
To such an extent that in the 19th century, some major charities, Guinness Trust, Peabody Trusts, Roundtree's, all these charities set up housing trusts to provide affordable housing. 1926, legislation was passed to allow local authorities to build housing and for that housing to be subsidised, to be affordable. From 76 onwards, that was hacked.
Mm.
There was a time when Heath and Wilson and McMillan were all saying, we will build 300,000 houses next year. No, we will build 400,000. In the beginning of in the 80s, there was one year, only 26 new houses were built in the public and quasi-public sectors.
Yeah.
And all of the best housing was sold out to people who were living in the best houses.
Yeah.
Most were living in poor quality flats of one sort or another. Were not really very interested in buying because they were still going to be within a large block where they didn't have to have contract.
Yeah.
Consequently, the worst of the housing is what remains. And because of that also, and because of a policy whereby points were awarded for housing according to social deprivation, the majority of people being housed were those who had serious social deprivation and wrecked communities. And the current government's policy of wanting to get 80% home ownership is crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I'll agree quickly. We are in a bit of a mess, but the great news is that it's not that the Luftwaffe have just come over and bombed our housing. It's not that we've had an earthquake. You know, it's the bulk of the housing stock is there. We are just not allocating it in a sensible way. By allocating in a sensible way, I don't mean going in and taking somebody's house from them. I mean having a government that doesn't have its main priority being to get the house price to go up and up and up again. Because as soon as you have, and it will happen, as soon as house prices begin to fall, hopefully gently and slowly, it's not worth hanging on in your house that's slightly too big for you. The faster you move out of it and downsize, the more money you can give your relatives. But while house prices are rising, it makes sense to hang on in there. So are those things you can do. We can also, we have the right to sell, we just don't know about it. It was used in Sheffield. So homeowners who fall on hard time, more people with mortgages, can apply to become tenants. The minute that begins to happen more widely, which will happen in the housing crash, it happened in the States, then suddenly the stigma of a housing association or council housing house goes because next door can be one, but we've also got to work out that at least a third to a half of the population will never be able to actually pay the cost of producing a house. Long term, council houses pay for themselves, but the rent, time after time after time, actually paid over two or three generations. But one generation can't pay for it. It's taken us too long to get there. The problem is that there is a group of people who would not be upset if we went back to a 90% renting society with pretty poor conditions for most renters, but you know, if you own 26 properties, you're doing fine. But we've been there before. It's what my granddad experienced, was a society of 90% renting. And 50% renting is fine. We're still a long way off 50% renting. But you want people to actually be able to do what they can do in other countries and make a choice between renting and buying. Personally, I'm useless at DIY. I don't like getting up ladders and fixing things. So if I had a choice, I'd much rather rent than buy. But because I've bought, I'm paying half as much every month for my mortgage that I would be paying on the rent for the same property. But the amount of money I've borrowed to buy a house built by a college gardener in Oxford is a larger mortgage than all my relatives have ever taken out, put together in the history of Dawlings. Now, I'll probably be okay, but some poor young person will be borrowing a fortune now or next autumn, it's normally the autumn, and that little flat they buy not in here will suddenly drop in value by 100,000 and they'll have 100,000 unsecured debt. That's going to happen to somebody. It happened in 1989 to a much smaller extent, but we've kind of forgotten about that. So it's not just people at the bottom who are hurt by this. Highly successful people at the top who do everything right, some of them are going to be the ones left holding the baby when it goes wrong. The faster it goes up, the bigger the fall you get. You really want to calm it down. I'll answer that with the next one. Yeah.
Would you like to say something about the social impact of zero-hours contracts?
Yes, zero-hours contracts. My house would be an investment, except I've got three children. If I just had one, they'd be fine, because they'd be able to take the value of that investment to get themselves a house, although they'd have to wait a long time for me to get out of it. As soon as you've got two or three children, you know, you're not solving their problems by your investment. Zero hours contracts have risen greatly in recent years, put people in a terrible situation of, because they don't know how much work they're going to have the next week or the next week. You can't easily take on other work because you might be required to work more by the supermarket who are employing you that way. It helps the unemployment statistics dramatically, because officially you're employed even if you work for no hours. The thing which has most helped the unemployment statistics is the massive rise in self-employment, a large amount of which is people who are actually unemployed. But if you're self-employed, you do almost anything, you can then get tax credits and other things rather than £10 job seekers allowance a day, you know, which is such a small amount of money. The other big problem with being unemployed now is that 2014, 1 million people were sanctioned. That is, they had made some mistake. They hadn't turned up to a meeting or something else. They might not have turned up to a meeting with the DWP because they're actually going for a job interview. But unless they told the DWP that was the reason, you still get sanctioned. Sanctioning is having part of your benefits taken away. And the amount of money those 1 million people in Britain had taken away in 2014 was more than all the fines given out that year by all the magistrates' courts in England and all the sheriff's courts in Scotland. It's the most amazing thing, really. It's like going back to poor law. And it was, in retrospect, it was the year where Sarah Teather burst into tears as the minister resigned. So you could tell she knew what was going on. When she resigned, senior members of the Liberal government and the Conservatives said, you need backbone to be in power. But in hindsight, we were doing this. It has the effect, sanctioning a million people and having one of the lowest rates of unemployment insurance in Western Europe, of getting unemployment really low. You can get unemployment to zero. It's really easy. You just get rid of all unemployment benefit. Then people will do anything. The lower less you give people, and the more you sanction them, the more they will do any job that they can find. Unemployment benefits in France and Germany can be 3 or 4 times as much. So it's amazing, I think, that we talk about people coming here for our benefits, when our benefits are actually so low. But we've gradually got this position. So we haven't recognised that it's strange. I don't know in what year the middle class stopped relying on the welfare state. You know, it doesn't ever cross my mind that I would ever use. You know, I would have to use family and some support. And there must have been a year at which very people stopped thinking of the safety net being a safety net for them. Whereas in a normal European country or a more progressive European country, you're looking at 80% of your salary being paid for 2 years until you can find another job. And you might say, that's madness, it can't work. But these countries are doing just as well as us for many people. These countries are allowing their children to go to university for free, but they see each other as belonging to something collectively. And we stopped doing that. And when we began to stop doing that, it kind of made some sense for people like me, because I pay less taxes than I'd have more. But the degree of precarity rises. And then you worry, even if you're okay like me, you worry what will happen to your children, and what will happen to one of my children who turns out not to be as robust as the other ones. And will my children in 50 years' time still talk to each other, or will their lives have drifted apart so much? That's the kind of thing that scares me. That's why I get bothered about this. Very selfish. You know, it's only me and my family. It's what Margaret Thatcher talked about. But even if I only worry about me and my family, it makes sense for me to worry about this. Let alone worrying about the situation where people far worse off than an Oxford University professor. I mean.
When I got married in Oxford in the 50s, to get a mortgage on a house, they would only lend you 3 times the annual income of the husband. The average wage then was about £750 a year. Yes. So the house I bought, about £2,700. Then after that, they've got more relaxed about mortgage. Is it four times, take the white income into account. Now, the idea was so that more people could buy their houses. But I think that all it did was force up the price of housing. What do you think about that?
Okay. It was an experiment. There was a genuine theory, and a theory that worked particularly well in theory, that if you relax things, if you relax the market, then people at the bottom, because they have further to go up, would do better, and it would equalise things out, and it would let people play. So I can remember, last thing I'll ever say about Margaret Thatcher, but she signed a World Health Organization target saying that health inequalities would halve by the year 2000. And she thought that her policies would do that. It wasn't done malevolently. In fact, they doubled, they didn't halve. But the same with this idea of free up the banks and building societies, do the big bang in 1986, let them lend, give people a chance, it'll all sort itself out and the whole country will be better. It was an experiment. Different, and America did it even more. Different countries did different experiments. We can now see the results of the experiment and we know what happens. And what happens is that people end up borrowing enormous amounts. They end up, even with very low interest rates, paying back a huge amount because they've had to borrow so much. That interest does go to somebody. It doesn't go to your average saver because you'll know what you're getting or getting on bonds if you're a saver. It goes to investors, top investors, who require 10% returns on their capital a year worldwide. And we just haven't factored into the account when you free things up, a small and very greedy group of people will find a way of making money out of others, and it doesn't cycle back into the economy. But we've tried it, we've seen it, and now we need to change it. My worry is that we're not doing much about this until that autumn comes, when somebody suddenly says that house isn't worth a million. It's that point. It's the point when sentiment goes. I was once in a house in Mayfair, which was a three-bed semi, and was going for 25 million. And it's at what point does somebody actually say a three-bed semi isn't worth 25 million? It's happened before. We've had numerous housing dips in the country before. I think we're looking at this again. It won't happen here. It'll happen in London. And when it happens in London, the wave will come out. 2.5 years later, there'll be a little dip here. If it's been like it's been before.
Thank you. Two things, one back to housing about brownfield sites and the other about regional inequality. One reads that builders don't like building on brownfield sites because it's more expensive, yeah. And yet they would clearly be better in the terms you were talking about in terms of reducing commuting. So should we subsidise builders to use brownfield sites? The regional question, we used to have something called regional policy, as you will know, from the 1930s right up to the end of the 1970s, spending more and more money on regional policy, and we reached a peak in the mid-70s. It mainly concerned the manufacturing industry, and I suppose one could argue that we haven't got much of that now, so service industry isn't so easy to move. But I wonder whether you still think there's a place for regional policy, should we try to go back to it in some form, and whether you think George Osborne's Northern Powerhouse in any sense fills the bill.
Yeah. Thank you.
I agree with building on brownfield first. We've only got four large house builders now. We used to have a few more and some medium-sized and small ones. The large majority went bust in 2008, 2009, 2010, when the house building absolutely collapsed. And it's created a bit of a mess over... House builders have now got an oligopoly so that they can hoard land, sit back and not do things unless they really want to. You could get a small house builder in Oxford to build on brownfield land, it's just they don't exist anymore to do it. I would be tempted to charge them more for doing it on the green field as a way of getting it, but it's just the same end result. And we need to start small companies doing building again. We shouldn't be relying on four large house building firms. A third of house building in Germany is self-build. Now, there isn't somebody actually building themselves, it's somebody hiring their own builder to build a house. And that's a third of all house building. But they have small builders there. The builder who helped me make the house I bought habitable was the same builder I worked for when I was 16 and 17 in Oxford. He's now in his 70s, his friends are in his 70s. It was rather like Last of the Summer Wine, instead of taking all the rotting wood out of this house for me. But he could still work because he had retired. The younger ones in Oxford are either working doing up the colleges, or they've left because the jobs went. Regional policy began with the Special Areas Act in 1934, I think, that was the key one. It ended in 2009, when the new Labour government, in its last year of office, took half of the regional aid money, or whatever it was called, and put it into what it called the Mortgage Rescue Scheme for the South East of England. And then the incoming government then got rid of the rest of it. Because New Labour were petrified that there would be a housing crash in the southeast of England, because house prices had halved in Cyprus and in Greece and in Portugal and in Spain and in Ireland and in Iceland, everywhere else around there. So we've lost it. We've had it for that length of time and we've lost it. I would reinstate it, not necessarily for industry, but because we're getting such a concentration of people down here that it is making life worse down here. And there are hills up there. There are lots of reasons why you might prefer, if you, it was a choice, to live in the north rather than the south. It's not a choice. Young people are coming down here and particularly to London because it's the only full-time, relatively well-paid jobs they can get. So something that makes things more viable, that's just a distance from London, would benefit London and benefit the rest. I'm not exactly sure what you would do, but I would be doing it as much in the interest of London as I would outside. The regional maps become really, really simple. The nearer your town or city is to London by train travel time at 9 in the morning, the higher your economic growth would have been. Nothing to do with you. It's distance to London that has become all important. The Northern Powerhouse is a tiny thing. But it is good to let the local area worry about things like its local hospitals. Because when I lived in Newcastle for 10 years, the NHS let the big Northern General Hospital be shut down. It was the big hospital in the West End, the poor end of the city. When the Northern General went, the West End went. Half the West End has now been bulldozed. So I think it's good for cities to have control over many things, because the repercussions of one decision are often not realised in a way they would be by people locally. You know, so if we're thinking about here and what's going to happen in Oxford and Oxfordshire, the repercussions of building roads or building trains or making that airport a commercial airport, you do want those decisions in the remit of somebody who's worrying about the whole area and not somebody who's worrying simply about the profitability of an airport or the profitability of a train station, because otherwise you could get unintended consequences.
I wasn't going to say anything, but I actually signed the contract selling the hospital in Newcastle.
Okay.
I can tell you that it was done for the benefit of the health of the population.
Yeah.
And in fact, Newcastle is just about the most successful trust in the whole country and provides high standard of care than virtually anywhere else. So it was justified. But I want to raise another point very quickly. Your equivalent, and you may have seen him on television, is the public health statistician from Sweden, who puts over these most incredible performances.
Yeah.
And came out in his latest presentation with figures that confirmed the United Nations ambition to abolish poverty within, I forgot what it is, 20 years or something. and gave the most incredible evidence that poverty in the world is falling rapidly, that education for women is up in the 90% across the world, that health has improved. So, looking at it globally, why does Britain fit in to what is happening in the rest of the world, where it seems poverty is genuinely being abolished?
Okay, it's Hans Rosling, it's a Swedish statistician who was a doctor. Before that. We'll have to talk about Newcastle later now, though. But I do agree, it's helpful, it's very, very good. Some things have gotten incredibly better worldwide. The most important one is infant mortality. So, infant mortality worldwide fell about 5% in 1 year, about 4 years ago. It's an incredibly fast drop, the fastest ever drop in babies dying. Despite the fact we have a bigger population now, there are fewer grieving parents now in the world than there were in the 1970s. Things have got so better so quickly. We don't have to worry about the bigger population because peak baby was 1990. Our fertility, over half the planet, is below 2 children per couple. We are set to peak in the lifetimes of the youngest people being born now. If things go well, we could peak at lower than 10 billion. This is all very good news. The fact that you had peak baby in 1990 means you've got peak 25-year-old now. So if you're wondering why lots of 25-year-olds are turning up, it's partly because so many were born 25 years ago. And we have had a rise in the global middle class. They live in China, and you know, they're on $7,000 a year, but that is what the global middle class is. We have had a fall in people on $1 a day and just under $2 a day, but we still have 800 million who are going hungry, but we also have 1 billion who are eating too much, and you can only eat so much food. You know, so these kind of things are objects for hope, and the education improvement is quite incredible. 90% of children in the world are now literate. Their grandparents were not. That change is very good. At the same time, though, the very richest in the world, the global 1%, now have just over 50% of all wealth. And there was a point last year where their wealth rate was increasing by 7% a year, which would mean in 7 years it's game over. So you can tell something really weird is happening at the moment. But I tend to agree with Hans. It is entirely possible that the future could be much better. The main reason, by the way, that we're going to get to 10 billion people isn't because of more babies, it's because of people living longer. If life expectancy in the world doubles, your population doubles. Because if people hang around for twice as long, you have twice as many people. So it's actually aging that's getting us there, not babies. We are odd. Of the 25 richest countries in the world, we are currently the third most unequal. The two above us are Singapore and the United States. We have bigger income inequalities than Israel. Our divides are bigger than Israel. In the US, Barack Obama has brought in some taxes and it's calming down. In Singapore, they've brought in some housing controls to stop Chinese investors buying flats and leaving them empty in Singapore because they are clever. So we are on track to become the most unequal of the 25 richest countries. Somebody's got to be. That's one optimistic, you know, somebody's going to be the most unequal of 25 richest countries. It's looking like us. I think it's understandable from the point of where we are, in that we were the richest country on the planet 100 years ago. We had an empire. It takes quite a long time to adjust from that. The United States, in effect, had an empire after us. We're an odd case. The world's most equal rich country didn't choose to become the most equal. Japan is the most equal rich country in the world because the Americans imposed equality upon it after the war and took the land from the aristocracy and gave it out because they're afraid of revolution. The Germans had a form of equality imposed upon them. Every city was given a function, and we built a wall through Berlin, which if you want to stop London getting powerful, that's the way to do it. But I think it's because of our strange historic position that we're up there. The richest country in the world before us was the United Provinces, centred around Amsterdam. And in Amsterdam, there's a set of houses on the canal where every transaction has been measured for about 400 years. So you've got a 400-year house price series. House prices there, in real terms, peaked in 1675 and then fell for 300 years. I'm not saying they're going to fall for 300 years now, but former world powers, the place that was the richest on the planet, have particular difficulty adjusting to becoming a normal country. And I think we're still going through that difficulty. We made a lot of our money from the fact that we had an empire. We told ourselves it's because we were good at building ships and we were good at doing that, but it was also because we had captive markets in India. We lost our captive markets in India and we lost them in Africa, and we don't quite realise that we have to do something, and that something has to be of value that people want, and we can't expect to have an average income that other countries have simply by doing things like being very clever with money and moving the money of other people around the world, not actually working that hard ourselves. That's my gut feeling about it, is that we haven't worked out that we need to do what the Germans have done. But it was much easier for the Germans to work out they needed to do it because of the situation that Germany was in.
Right. That's everybody's questions? Yes?
One last one?
Okay, this is the last one.
Thank you. Given the size of China, when you're giving world statistics, I mean, if China gets a lot of literacy, how much does it really make the world look much better than it is?
Okay, last question. If you take China out, then that hand-flossing picture of the world becoming a better place goes. And India doesn't look very good compared to China over what's happened there. But it's not fair to take China out. I mean, China's interesting in this story of world powers. The United Provinces, England, the United States, and it's increasingly looking, even with just 7% growth a year, China may well be the next one, and that rise matters. But if you take China out, then you're looking at a much more polarised world with much lower gains in India in particular and many countries in Africa. Things have been improving very, very slowly. They're at such a low base that even a tiny improvement looks amazing, but it still doesn't drag people up to something you wouldn't see as poverty. But it's happened. I mean, and the amazing thing is that it's happened under a system that we no longer... I mean, it is still a communist country, but with a market system within it. But the other thing that's happened in China, and this is worth thinking about for population for us, is that China did it partly by bringing in a one-child policy. Bringing in a one-child policy early. Fertility in China dropped from 6 children per woman to 2 before the one-child policy. When you only have one child, that suddenly frees up the adult labour to do more work. And so you're able to put more people into factories, and particularly women, because you were halving the number of children they had. You can then be very productive for one generation, or for two, but what you're finding now in China is population halving. Rapid population decline. They've relaxed the one-child policy, so you're allowed to have two, and found that people don't want to have two. They've got used to having one. And I don't think there's enough. In Tokyo, they have one. In Barcelona, it's one. In Shanghai, it's one is the average. These cities only sustain themselves by pulling in migrants to keep themselves going. But I think it's worth looking at. The problem in China is for grandparents, where you have 4 grandparents, 2 children and 1 grandchild, and when that grandchild dies, and the Chinese state haven't yet addressed that particular problem. But this is a brave new world, the new world in which in many countries, and for some of your children, certainly your grandchildren, a quarter of young adults in Britain will not have children, half because they find that they can't and half choose not to. And of the majority who are left, most will have one child or two, and fewer will have three than have one or two. And it's qualitatively different than the choices that are made in the past between having five or four or three. And once it becomes normal to have one, it's much easier to have one because your single child is no longer odd. There are lots of other single children to play with. And these are the kind of things we have to think about and worry about. We talk about, I managed to get away without talking about migration or getting a question. We talk about the fact that Germany has space for lots of Syrians because its population growth has been lower. Our fertility rate has been below two children per couple since the 1970s. The only reason this country hasn't shrunk is immigration. And it may get a lot lower. The only place, the only region in the United Kingdom with a growing number of British-born people is London. And the reason London's got a growing number of British-born people is because it's got so many immigrants who were born in Britain who are having children in London. The demographics are fascinating at the moment of what's going on. I'll end because I did promise to say something about that vote. I'm ambiguous about that vote. It's 50-50, it's going to be a very big thing. You're probably going to get sick of it by the time we actually get to the referendum. The really interesting thing in terms of inequality and housing is what happens, well, partly if you have a debate about whether you want these people here and they're here. I wonder how people who are here from mainland Europe are going to feel about this debate and hearing people talk about them. But if you vote to leave, you're going to reduce the demand for coming in dramatically. People who are already here, some of them might decide to go back to Berlin and Paris because they feel not wanted. Other people, of course, won't be able to come in as easily. What's going to happen to house prices then if there's a vote to leave the European Union? Part of me thinks it's the fastest way to create a more equal country. It's just going to be a fairly devastating way to create a more equal country if we do that. And it's not impossible that we do it, but the effects are widespread, not least because the faculty of the University of Oxford I work in, one third of our income comes from the European Union. So what will I be doing in 2 years' time if we vote to leave? I'll be drawing up lists of people, trying to work out who's going to go. And then suddenly Oxford will become really cheap to live in. But it might not be the way you want Oxford to become really cheap to live in. Thank you very much.
Thank you.